papers by Dr. Myri, Progress in Cluster-Enabled LENR. Dr. Myri, as you all know, has been at the University of Illinois for many years, and he has been in the field for almost 30 years. So, yes.
Thank you. This is by myself and the industrial heat laboratory in Champaign, Urbana, the group that they are supporting there. Again, as in the previous first talk today, we want to thank them for their very generous support and encouragement. Outline. I'm going to talk about a lot of things, but let me say this. What we're trying to do is understand a reproducible way of producing particles that will produce excess heat. And, of course, due to reactions in the process. And the way we're viewing that is that the basic concept involves creating defects in the material and in the process loading these defects with gas such that you get a sort of Bose-Einstein condensate into the defect, and that this creates a very dense state, which is a nuclear reaction site that produces the heat and reactions. So we've been doing a lot of work along those lines, so let me proceed ahead. I have a lot of slides and going through this fairly fast. We have posters that go into more details, and other members of the team are manning these posters and can fill you in if you have a chance to get by there. I think very good. Here's our industrial heat lab team in Champaign, and there are five of us from this team here. So the concept of the defect forming clusters originates from electrolytic work we did with thin films. And as shown here, we have a thin film which down here at the bottom, we produce thin film, oxidize the surfaces, did electrolytic runs with that, and as shown in the next slide, if you do a temperature controlled gas pressure release from these, if you simply put the thin film electrode in as I showed, did nothing to it before you did the run, and then pulled it out and measured the gas release as a function of temperature, you'd get a line something like this. However, if you load and deload it many times and then do this, you'll find that you get this peak release at higher temperature, which is attributed to the fact that in the loading deloading, what you're doing is creating many defects, which are where these dense clusters are formed, and those in turn then give us release from the bound cluster at the higher temperatures. And we also did these measurements with a squid device, which showed that these clusters were essentially superconducting at around 70 degrees K. And I've shown those in previous talks. What we wanted to do then is move ahead to nanoparticles and gas loading, so that we felt that would be a more convenient way of having commercial devices. So today what we're talking about is actually the nanoparticles. Now the trick here is to figure out how to prepare the nanoparticles so that they have increased defects, so you can get a high density of these clusters within the nanoparticles. And that's a different ball game from this loading, deloading we were talking about. And much of it goes back to the manufacture of the nanoparticles. So we have studied in some experiments that I'm showing you here, two different types of nanoparticles. They're both of the same composition, roughly, with palladium and zirconium. And the concept of that composition comes from, what we had before, where we had palladium oxide. Here, we're using zirconium, which turns out to be a separate phase that condenses out in palladium when we manufacture it such that it can anchor the formation of the defects, which then, in turn, are where the clusters form. And so that's the reason for a selection of that type of composition. Now, we have what we call a legacy type, which were first the alloy composition was created in this high temperature furnace. This in turn then was milled in just a standard ball milling machine at room temperature. And that would be what we call the legacy particles. Now our NT, new particles, so to speak, have been produced somewhat differently. We have a arc furnace to produce the alloy, and then we have a cryogenic mill that we do the milling in, which doing that low temperature again emphasizes or produces more defects per cubic centimeter, we hope. And so we're looking at that. Some of the comparison, I'll show you some for palladium spheres, which were not ball milled at all. I'll show you some palladium that has no zirconium that has been ball milled using the same process of cryo-milling as a comparison. The thought is that if we haven't used our milling process, we probably shouldn't produce sufficient defects to have much reaction occurring. So, moving ahead. Oops, I'm going backwards. Yes, I am. Sorry about that. Just a couple pictures of the stuff that were taken to give you a concept of something like a 1.5 micrometer size particles. And if you look at them before milled, but cryo-milled, not oxidized, you can get what you see on the left. On the right is oxidized particles. It's hard to really correlate, make sure that we, when I said that we are producing more defects, more clusters with our type of milling process. One thing that we are doing is NMR experiments using one of the labs at the University of Illinois to see if we can get a better insight into that. And here you'll notice that the anyway, you'll notice two different formations of hydrogen when we've done that in some experiments, indicating that we have hydrogen bound in two energy states, which can come from two different types of defects, and hence two different cluster sizes being created in the process. That's ongoing work. What we have done a good bit on is using a pressure depressurization calorimeter. The calorimeter has inside it this vessel that contains the vessel there that contains the nanoparticles, and then a vacuum chamber and the outside wall as a heat transfer medium. And we have thermocouples on the outside wall, thermocouples here. We're measuring the heat losses between the two, which is dominated by radiation from the inside to outside, but some conduction through the filling lines. And we take that into account with calculation also with thermocouples along those. So a typical run with this, what we've been doing is we first pressurize, and you get a rapid increase in temperature, and then a decrease. Then we, once it comes back to around room temperature, we draw a vacuum, depressurize, and there you get a cooling effect as the either hydrogen or deuterium in the particles is coming out, and it comes takes a longer time to come back to the beginning temperature. So this is a typical cycle, and we're doing this way because if we take the differences between this and this, we can determine if there's an excess heat being produced, and that uses the same vessel. So the calorimetry is, errors in calorimetry tend to cancel out between the two, and that helps us in terms of, helps us in terms of accuracy. So the analysis is to take using thermocouples and radiative and conductive heat transfer calculations is to take the difference between those two, and the difference probably best shown in this graph is then what we're attributing to the net excess energy coming out due to LENR reactions. So if you look at this, here's the graph I showed earlier, conceptually, heating, cooling. If you take the energy under this curve and conceptually put it back over here, if there is an additional value, that would be an excess, because it, for a reversible process, the energy produced due to the chemical portion of the loading would be balanced by the cooling energy in during the deloading. In practice, it's harder to extract or deload, so that in practice, actually, you'll find that if you take the difference between the two and there were no excess due to reactions, it was all chemical, you would get a negative value for the difference. In other words, you wouldn't get a red
occur, you get a negative value. And we'll see that later. So I'm going to show a lot of data. We've done a number of experiments over 6 months. We've been varying a lot of things, so a lot of the data has some scatter in it. But what we notice is that we've always gotten the excess net energy out, but there's big scatter in it. That's because we've been changing a lot of things in most part. We then made some runs where we didn't change things, trying to show a consistent reproducibility, and show you that. So we used zirconia without any palladium and so on as a baseline run to test our calorimetry, and so there shouldn't be any excess there. We used palladium microspheres, which were not milled, which were not treated, which we didn't expect to have many defects and so on. So that when we did run the fit, we actually got these negative values for the net energy out, as I just indicated we should get. And now, when we did other runs, though, if you focus mainly on the left graph here, we did these with the palladium that was milled same way, and we expect some reactions occurring there, the legacy particles and the new particles, and they're shown in a histogram. So what we have there is the amount of excess joules produced in these runs and the number of runs that produced that amount. And you'll see a lot of the cryomill type of particles were in this range here. One outlier. As expected, we got a little bit of excess from the palladium, and the legacy particles are more down there someplace. And if we look at it in terms of the percent produced, excess first numbers of runs, they get grouped into this range here, and we get some outline in that range. I think let me pass by that. And trying to sort those out in terms of variations that were being made during those runs, which caused some difference, is if we tried to correlate the excess versus the mass, you see that there's a reasonable correlation, is virtually a straight line going up here for that. Versus pressure, a lot more variation, and isn't quite as clear what's happening. Looks like there's an increase in excess of increase of pressure up to 50 psig, but if we go above that, looks like if anything it comes back down again some, or maybe the line here and maybe one across that way. I don't know. We'd have to investigate that a lot, but the nice thing is we don't have to go to excessively high pressure. So there were substantial variations in those results due to those changes of the type I just showed. If we go on to reproducibility runs, we ran some where we expected to always get the same results by keeping everything constant, and here we had something like that. This would be the run number, and we should have gotten a straight line here. So we have variations like so for always the same amount, same pressure, same temperature runs, and so on. And it's interesting to put those back into the previous graph that we showed And you see the blue ones are the reproducibility ones, which sort of lay in the center of all the scatter we had from the previous run for things being buried. We've looked at a lot of different things. One of the obvious worries is whether or not oxidation reactions are occurring to give false signals and so on. I'd reference you to go to this poster that's by Jake Meyer and Han is going to be presenting that for him. In most cases, what we always have done is eliminate the data from the first run when we put new particles in, and the first run usually gives a much larger excess heat due to some oxidation reduction that's still taking place. But in our experience, after the first run, if we've started with new particles or we open up the vessel exposed to air and start over again, if you eliminate the first run, you're usually okay. I think we'd summarize most of that by saying within the data we have taken from that, it seems conclusive to us, at least thus far, that there is an important LENR effect taking place. Since we worry some about this calorimetry and issues there, an additional experiment we did was a water bath experiment. And the water bath experiment was very simple. We simply put a pressure vessel inside a tube of water, and the temperature of the water should increase to some value above the room temperature if there is a net power out as you oscillate between pressurization and depressurization. So as it's going up and down, there should be a net heating of the water. And if there's any heating of the water, that shows if we're getting a net output. So unfortunately, the size of the vessel we could put in, the amount of powder we can put in, and so on here, were limited by just the equipment we had quickly available. So this thing was maybe not as impressive as you like, but it shows what we wanted to show. This is a calibration of a Calorite heater in it, and we can see that with 0.05 watts input, we get a temperature increase of about a degree C. So it's reasonably, we try to keep the amount of water fairly low so that it's reasonably sensitive. Run that illustrates that we did succeed in this. This is a 5-hour run, and we start here, and you can see the pressurization, depressurizations, many of them, timing being that it was pressurized every 2 minutes for 30 seconds and depressurized for 90 seconds. And this big gap in the center was where we depressurized over much longer period, just to restart again. And you can see we leveled out until we finally depressurized here toward the end. So there's a very distinct heating. And this is a run that was made over an extended period of time, and you can see produced around 4.6 kilojoules. And summary of runs in this water bath over a number of days, So we ended up with around 16 kilojoules produced in the water bath over these various runs. So trying to further look into the use of this for demonstration that it was a nuclear reaction, we were looking for reaction products and wanted to consider changes in the metal, which we can measure SIMS and so on, or in the gas, RTG, or with CR39 type of things. I think it's simplified with the present equipment we have. We weren't able to measure changes in the gas composition. We need to do more work on that. Likewise, unfortunately, due to contamination that's produced both in the in the milling and run process, we have great difficulty in measuring accurately the changes in the isotopic compositions. I don't know, the only thing that seemed to be happening in the first ones that was above the noise level. I think a lot's happening below the noise level with changing in some of the silver isotopes. So we need to do a lot more work in that. I think what's most evident at the moment is CR39. We've worked hard on that. With the CR39, we've tried to concentrate on a process where we are able to examine a whole slice of the CR39 in a consistent manner based on training using a reference like, for example, starting here with uranium-238 images, train our microscope and software system so it can recognize such tracks and go from frame to frame and doing it. And we have two things here. First, this thing's running here, but first the trick is to get the CR39 into the vessel with the nanoparticles and also have it such that we know where the CR39 is in the vessel and cover a range along the radius of the particles in the vessel. So on the left is a special one that we built, special vessel, pressure vessel, and we put a cup in it, has slots in it, and see these slots hold slices of CR39 that we put in here that are sitting vertically. We're looking down the top of the vessel there. And then if we run through that in the system that I showed you, for example, on the right-hand side, here's the background. This is sort of a three-dimensional view that gives the number of a given type of track that's found in per unit area in a given region of the CR39. So we have this showing along the CR39 is stuck down in there, and we have this region here is where that top is, and this is down at the bottom. Anyway, when we've done three pressure cycles, six, and then go up to 9 and 12, you can see that we're getting very noticeable increases in tracks and what have you as we're doing that. So the plan is to eventually use that as a method for even studying the reaction site densities. So, in conclusion, we've a lot of data built up now in this pressure depressurization type device. Incidentally, I forgot to say, the CR39 is also discussed in great detail in a poster by our group, and so you can see that. And what I was going to say is that we have a lot of data from this pressurized depressurizing. What we want to do is move on to higher temperature runs. That was all done at low temperatures. At higher temperatures, we're hoping that we don't have to do pressurization, depressurization. We have some data that would suggest that we should be able to eventually get a steady state run without requiring that. So we want to move to high temperatures. There's also a poster that discusses our design for doing that. So you can go to that to look at what we were planning. I want to say that if that doesn't really pan out, it's still possible to make some type of prototype device that would be of interest, although it's not as much of interest because of the poor temperature energy conversion to, say, electricity and so on, but for power, if we stay where we are, and we have slides, don't have time to go through them, where you can just do what we were saying with pressurized, depressurizing a series of vessels here, and if we have proper heat exchangers and so on, you can get a reasonably efficient system for doing that. And so if you take the data that I showed earlier, well, it didn't seem like it was that impressive, maybe, but still you could work it out so you get a 50-watt system based on having something like 86 grams of nanoparticles per vessel, giving a total of 516. Or if you don't want to put that much into it, we can go down to 29 grams per vessel and get 32 watts out. So the pressurization, depressurization cycles could produce a device, but it's not quite what we want. So, oops, I went the whole way. So, in addition to the great support from Industrial Heat, we had some support from NPL Associates Inc. and from NUNICO. And I think it's obvious from what I said, all of this discussion of calorimetry, excess heat, et cetera, is based on what we've done thus far, and we haven't had anyone replicate that. So it's not to be taken, I think, until that is done. Thank you.
Thank you, David. We have a 3 hour time. We've already run 10 minutes into lunchtime, and he has many posters, and his young and enthusiastic students are really available. So I encourage you to take up the questions at that time. Thank you, everybody, and thank you once again.